Hello everyone, I'm Gary Elwood with ProQuest Technologies. Welcome to today's call. Now I know John's got a lot of great information to cover with you here today, so I'm very quickly going to go ahead and turn it over to you, John. Take it away.
Thank you, Gary. Hi everyone, welcome to today's call. We're going to be working this month on business planning and writing a simple but effective business plan. Now, just to set the table a little bit, you know, this information can be a little dry, and I'm going to do my very best not to make it so. And I found myself thinking this morning, like this subject matter can sometimes be right up there with time management. I remember when I took both a time management course and a business planning course, I literally fell asleep in both of them. So it doesn't say much, for the material, I guess. It can be, like I said, a little dry. As I also said, I will do my very, very best to keep it moving and keeping exciting for us. But here's the deal, guys. It's interesting because I've been talking to all of my clients about, you know, November being business planning month, and just about everyone I had spoken with today, you know, we talked about the idea of getting their business plan started. We want to finish it by Thanksgiving. And I want to set the table here by saying we are a business. You know, we are a business. We are a small business. And the idea is that if we fail to plan, meaning if we fail to write a simple but effective business plan, we're planning to fail. Let me say that again, and it's a pretty common saying. You've probably heard it before. If you fail to plan, you're planning to fail. So I want to encourage everybody to at least, if you want to, create a simpler version of what I'm going to share with you. I'm not going to get overly elaborate here, I promise you. Simple, straightforward, clear, concise. If you can do an 8-step business plan like I'm going to teach you how to do, you'll be just fine. But if you want to tweak it a little and make it, you know, a 4-step business plan, you know, kind of idea, a 5-step business plan, and you want to make it your own, you want to eliminate some of the pieces of this, that's just fine. The point is that as long as you do it. Now, some sections of the business plan are non-negotiable. There are some sections of your business plan you really got to do. And I'm going to spend a good deal of time on those. And that's starting with the first section, you know, step one are your goals. I'm going to spend some considerable time on goal setting, because what I will tell you is that in the real estate business, it's an area that gets a lot of agents into trouble. And we'll explain that in a second. So what we want to do is we want to go out and we want to go to Staples or Office Max or one of those supply stores, and we want to buy ourselves a 1.5-inch 3-ring binder, right? Go buy a 1.5-inch 3-ring binder, a couple of bucks, right? And to get a package of Avery page dividers so that you can divide your plan into eight sections. And we're gonna label or print out the 8 sections that we've got listed here in your outline. So your first section is goals, and I'm going to jump right in with goals. And I'm going to spend a good deal of time here with goals because, again, this is an area that gets many, many people into trouble. And if you've been on these calls for any length of time, you've heard me discuss this area over and over and over again because it's so important and because it's so misunderstood and because it gets so many of us into trouble. So goal setting is both an art and a science. There's a lot of confusion around this area of goal setting. There seems to be a lot of puff and no stuff. You know, it's in an area where, you know, carries a lot of emotion. You know, you go to a seminar and, you know, the speaker talks about goal setting. I remember Zig Ziglar's epic audio program on goal setting, and he kept saying, you got to have goals. You got to have goals. And I agree with that. But, you know, I've added some science to the mix because this was an area, guys, that I struggled with mightily. I mean, it was a Herculean thing for me because here's the deal. I would habitually set my goals too high. And yes, there is such a thing as setting our goals too high. And despite what a lot of people in the personal development / speaking industry will tell you, there is such a thing. And I get pushback on this all the time, and I struggle with my clients and them setting their goals too high as well. Because what ends up happening when you set goals too high, and we're going to talk a little more in depth about this, because this is normally the challenge for people in the real estate business. They set their goals too high. And when you do that and you don't reach your goals, you're frustrated and you feel like you failed. And it's not the goal, and I want you all to get this. It's not the goal that's the issue. It's never the goal that's the issue. It's the timeline that we attach to that goal. And the other thing that gets us into trouble is that we kind of set goals for other people on our team. And they're maybe not as committed to those goals as we are, or as committed to those goals that we would like them to be. And that can cause problems too. And we can come up real short of the bullseye that we set for ourselves. So we're going to talk again more in depth about this. But I'm what you call an empiricist. Right? I'm an empiricist. I base my ideas and theories, in many areas on testing and experience, on good research. I don't want to be involved in solely a puffery, a pie in the sky, emotionally based goal setting exercise. That doesn't work for me. It really doesn't. And I rely heavily on the research of Dennis Waitley. Dennis Waitley, back in the day, he's a very famous psychologist, Dr. Dennis Waitley. He wrote a book which was on the New York Times bestseller list for, I think, almost a year, maybe more. And that was The Psychology of Winning. That was his probably most famous work. And then he also was the head psychologist for the U.S. Olympic team when the Olympics were held in Los Angeles. A number of years back, the most famous athlete out of those Olympics was a gal by the name of Mary Lou Retton. You may remember her. She was a gymnast. And Dennis Waitley's work in this area of goal setting, the body of work is called Flex Tactics, Flex, F-L-E-X, Tactics. And it was great research on goal setting. It's the best research I've ever seen. And in that research, Dr. Waitley worked with world-class athletes, world-class businesses, and believe it or not, former POWs. And so it was a really great body, still is a really great body of research in this area. I would say it's layman's research. It's research that we can understand and we can easily digest. And it'll really help us if we can, get our mind around it. So the deal with goal setting is that Dr. Waitley based his research on mainly champions, with the exception of the POWs. And these were POWs from the Korean War. Back in the day, they used to call it the Korean conflict. My father was in the Korean War, fought. And he was a Marine. And what had happened, and this is very compelling to me, what had happened was the communist Chinese were actually behind the Korean conflict. And when they would capture a U.S. military person, prisoner of war, they would very quickly interrogate that prisoner of war, and they would ask him a series of questions. And these questions were, on the surface, kind of innocent, but they were designed to find a specific end. They were designed to find how this individual was wired. So they would ask things like, well, what are your plans when you get home? Do you have a family? Do you plan on continuing your education? Do you have any goals for yourself? Where do you see yourself when you get back home working? And what they did very cleverly, communist Chinese, is they separated these POWs into two groups. The first group were considered non-threats, no threat at all. And these prisoners of war had relatively no serious restrictions upon them. They got clean shelter, clean food every day. They had recreation. They were treated fairly well, but they were considered a non-threat to the communist Chinese because they really were aimless people. They had no ambition. So the communist Chinese kind of let them go. The POWs that were interrogated that had goals, that had a reason, had a big why, you know, to get back home, these people were considered a big threat. And these POWs were subjected to horrible conditions, horrible treatment, sometimes torture. They were in every way, shape, and form, I believe, emotionally, mentally, and physically tortured. Well, here's the interesting piece. When these two groups got back home, the incidences of addictions, drug and alcohol addictions, the incidences of suicides, mental health issues, relationship issues, the inability to adjust back to a normal life here in the States was significantly higher among the first group, the group that was considered not really a threat and who were, as POWs fly, you know, were treated fairly well. So you think about that, right? You think about that. It's profoundly important. Profoundly important. And it's not just the fact that the group that was considered a threat had goals, had ambition, had a direction in life. That's not the point. The point is what kind of sickness and addictions and horrible things that people in that first group faced when they got back here because they were quote unquote aimless, right? Because they didn't have a direction, they didn't have goals. You know, what kind of issues does that cause in our lives? So I agree with Zig, you got to have goals, right? You got to have goals. But my feeling around that is based more on research than it is on emotional appeal. Now, just a caveat here, just a little addition. You know, I personally believe that we've been engineered by our creator to be goal-seeking mechanisms. And as long as we're seeking goals that we're in within the context of our creator's will for our lives, we're going to be just fine, right? That's how I roll. So we can set our goals based on ego, right? Or we can set our goals based on spirit. That's my take on this. I choose at this point in my life to base my goals on spirit, you know, thoughtfully and prayerfully consider what it is that I want to accomplish and make sure that I'm on solid ground there. Because, you know, goals based on ego will take you, can take you pretty far, guys. But I said this last coaching session, you know, be careful. Because you might find out that when you get to the top of the ladder of success, it's leaning against the wrong building. And the streets are littered with people who have done that and have destroyed their relationships and have destroyed their connection with their kids and who have destroyed their health and who have destroyed their reputation and have messed up their integrity and have, you know, dropped the bomb on their spiritual lives, and on it goes. So be careful here. Flashing, this is serious business, you know, flashing yellow light. So what causes underachievement according to Whateley's research? Three things: no goals at all, goals that are too high, and goals that are too low. These three things, according to the research, will guarantee that we underachieve. You know, to be brutally honest, we've got to throw away, you know, these sayings like, you know, reach for the stars, and even if you get to the clouds, you'll win, you know. Or reach for the sun, but if you land, you know, if you end up on the moon, that's not so bad. Look, those things are all well and good, but you've got to be careful. You've got to be careful. And I'll go into this in some depth. Like I said, this first section of the business plan to me is the heart and soul. It's the foundation upon which all the other sections will rest. And we got to get this one right, guys. I want to see you achieve at the highest levels. I want to see you all achieve at a level where you have done your very best and achieved the very most you can within the context of your talents and abilities and still have a life. So again, the causes of underachievement: no goals, goals too high, goals too low. People on this call, by and large, are going to be in the too high category, like I was. You're going to set your goals too high. So I want to tell you a story that Dave Liniger, who is the founder and now the chairman of the board of RE/MAX International, used to tell many, many years ago. When I first started out in real estate, I was in the Century 21 system, and then I joined RE/MAX, I guess, in about 1988, somewhere in there. And Century 21 at the time was the franchise du jour, but RE/MAX was the rising star. I mean, RE/MAX was coming on the scene strong in the late 80s, early 90s, and eventually, you know, became took Century 21's place as the big franchise. So back in those days, Dave Liniger, while he was building the company, used to travel around to the different regions in RE/MAX, and you know, it was a far different company then, and he would speak to us and you know, it's the kind of thing where you could have a beer with him, you know, afterwards in the bar. And he used to tell this story about it was a tale of two RE/MAX agents. And so one RE/MAX agent, you know, this guy set a goal and he said, I'm going to earn X amount of dollars this year and I will work day and night to achieve that goal. And the other RE/MAX agent set the same goal. He said, I want to earn this much, but listen, I want to have room in my life for other things. And, you know, I really only want to put in maybe a solid 50 hours a week to achieve this goal. And he said at the end of the, you know, at the end of the year, they both achieved the goal. But the first guy did indeed work day and night to achieve his goal. And lo and behold, the second guy who achieved the same goal ended up working, you know, the 50 hours that he designated for work time. And Dave's point is still valid today, all these years later. If you set a goal and you tell yourself or you tell your brain that you're going to work day and night and you'll do whatever it takes, and, you know, even if it means being bludgeoned at the finish line, your brain will take you at your word and you will work day and night and you will be bludgeoned at the finish line and you will achieve your goal. But far better to be really clear about the goal that you want and, you know, how you want it to roll, the outcome within reason that you want it to roll. Now, look, here's the other problem in real estate. You know, I see programs, you know, double your income, double your time off. Okay. These are all programs where somebody's trying to sell you something, right? And usually that something isn't something that's viable, that's doable. So double your income, double your time off. You know, the sky's the limit. I saw a program, the sky's the limit. I'm trying to think of a third one here. It's eluding me. I know what it was. How I made $1 billion in real estate and worked 2 hours a week, or some variation on that theme. Guys, if you want to go to programs like that, you know, I obviously can't stop you, but what I will tell you is that, you know, three things are going to become of a program like that if you go to it. Number one is you might be jazzed, you know, for a day or so, but you're going to get back home after a program like that and reality is going to set in and you're going to know at some level that it was all a bunch of hype. The second thing that's going to happen is somebody's going to want to sell you something, right? And usually something that's pretty expensive. You know, if you want to double your time and double your time off, you got to buy this, that, or the other thing, right? And the third thing that's going to happen is you're just going to waste your time because you'll get there if you've got half a brain and know that this is all BS. Can you double your income in real estate? Yes, at certain production levels. And this is one thing that I want you all to get, okay? Now, living here in the South, every time I say you all, it hurts my ears. Because up where I'm from in Philly, it's you guys, right? It's you guys, right? You get down South long enough, you start saying you all. It doesn't sound right when a Yankee says it. So the thing that I want you all to get is this. It is possible to double your production in real estate at certain levels. For example, if you are doing 12 transaction sides a year, you can pretty handily double that in a year if you know what you're doing and you've got some good guidance and direction. You can go from 12 to 24, no problem, right? I would say, I won't say easily, but pretty handily. What if you're doing 50 sides? Can you double that to 100 in 1 year? Probably not. 100 to 200, no way, right? So if you know, if you're starting out and you're at these lower levels of production, yeah, you can definitely double your productivity with handily. You know, where does it start falling apart? I would tell you it probably starts falling apart when you're maybe at 24 transaction sides a year. You know, going from 24 to 48 is pretty tough. I'm not saying that's not doable, but it's starting to get into the red zone, right? Going from 50 to 100, not happening in a year. 100 to 200, are you kidding me? It flies in the face of the research. What the research tells us, you know, with what? World-class athletes, world-class businesses, that once you get at a certain level, and again, I'll say that level is about 24 to 30 sides in the real estate business, our business. You know, typically then it's 20 to 25% more each year. Now, can people achieve beyond that? Yes, of course they can. Can they double it? Yeah, once in a while you'll see that. But for most of us, the wheelhouse is 20 to 25% more a year once we get to about 30 transactions. Well, look, guys, at that level, you're doubling your business every 3 to 4 years. I mean, how many businesses can say, you know, we double every 3 to 4 years? You know, so if you're at 30 transaction sides, 3 to 4 years, you'll be at 60. If you play your cards right, you have good coaching, you know, you can go from 60 to 120 in another 2 to 3 years. I mean, you can have one heck of a career. I'll never forget the story of a young guy, true story, that called me, and this guy was doing about, he was doing well. I mean, he's doing about 40 transaction sides a year. He wanted to talk to me about coaching and said, I want to take my business from 40 to 200 transactions. And I said, great, that's going to take you, it's going to take you some time. It's probably going to take you 5 years at least to do that. And he said to me, well, you know, look, if you're not a coach who can get me there in a year, I don't think you're the coach for me. And I said, well, look, I wish you luck, because you're right, I'm not the coach for you. I will never believe in a million years that you have the capability to do that. I don't. No amount of desire and commitment is going to make that happen. You don't have the infrastructure. And if you were to go from 40 to 200 transactions with what you got in play now, it will kill you. It will absolutely kill you. And so, you know, I hung up. I wished him good luck. I don't know whatever happened to that kid. But I can promise you this, he didn't go from 40 to 200 transaction sides in 1 year. That I can promise you. So guys, the point here is to be very thoughtful, be very deliberate about what you're setting here. There's way too much emotion that is inserted into this equation around goal setting. And base it on, again, you know, thought, deliberation. If you're somebody that you know, has a belief in a higher power like I do, you know, base it in your faith. Base it in the infrastructure that you've got in play. Base it in the experience that you have and the number of people who are in your sphere of influence, for sure. Base it on your past performance, your best past performance, but be thoughtful. Gosh, you know, so many years I pulled the trigger in this area of goal setting based on none of that stuff, based purely on what my ego said I should be able to do, right? You know, where did this 20 to 25% idea come from in Wheatley's research? Well, he was studying businesses, and these were Fortune 500 companies. And these companies, there used to be a charity called UNICEF. And it was around this time of year, it was around Halloween, that they had their big, you know, their big charity drive. And it used to be called, some of you might remember if you're older like I am, right? You'll remember the tagline was Trick or Treat for UNICEF, Trick or Treat for UNICEF. And so these companies had all, you know, the first year collected X number of dollars in their charity drive, and they were asked to set goals for the following year. And so some of these companies doubled and tripled and quadrupled. You know, they went nuts in terms of, you know, what they thought that they could achieve in terms of these charity drives. And by and large, the companies that hit their goals were in that 20 to 25% increase wheelhouse. The companies that went beyond that, you know, doubling and tripling and 50% more and 75% more, here's the rub, guys. And this is what you got to be careful about when you set goals too high. Not only did they not hit the mark that they set, not only did they not achieve the goal, but they actually regressed from what they had accomplished the year before. See, that's what's at risk. That's what's at risk here. You know, so it's, you know, missing the mark is bad enough. Regressing like is rubbing salt in the wound, for crying out loud. I mean, really? You want to go backwards? Well, then just set that emotionally charged pie in the sky goal. Don't be thoughtful. Don't be prayerful. Don't be deliberate. Don't base it on anything in reality. Just throw a number out there that makes you feel good because somebody else did it, or because this is what you need to do the things you want to do financially, whatever it might be. No, it's not a good plan. Again, if you're at lower levels of production, let's talk. Because you can go from 12 to 24. But you're up there in that 30 wheelhouse. You want to go to 60. Ugh, that's tough, man. That's tough. I don't care who you are. So, what we want to do is we want to be in the Goldilocks zone. Do you remember Goldilocks and the three bears? So she, you know, went to their house and, you know, she was eating their oatmeal. You know, this one's too hot, this one's too cold, this one's just right. And she slept in the beds, this one's too hard, this one's too soft, this one's just right. So you want to be in that Goldilocks zone with your goals. And here's the other thing that I will tell you. You want to have a range of goals, and you want to state those goals based on transaction size. We're talking about your production goals here, by and large, but we're going to talk about other goals just in a second. In fact, I might take this whole session talking about goals, because like I said, you can't get this piece right, the rest of your business plan isn't going to matter, ladies and gents. Not going to matter. So, here's the deal. When I talk to agents and I talk about their goals, oftentimes, they talk to me about their goals in millions, right? Say, okay, so what's your goal, Sally? Well, you know, this year I'd like to do about 16 million. I did about 12 million last year. Joe over here is doing 14, 15 million. I think that I'm as good as him. So 16 million is my goal. Okay. Can I tell you all something? That doesn't tell your brain anything. Your brain can't process that and can't bring that into reality. It is puffery. I'm sorry. I know there's some franchises out there. And if you're part of one of those franchises, let me apologize, because I'm not taking a hit at the franchise. I'm taking a hit at the culture that teaches people to talk in that manner. It's nonsense. It's gibberish. Your brain can't execute that simply and effectively. You'll talk to other agents and say, well, what do you want to accomplish next year? Well, I'd like to do 500,000 in GCI. Okay, great. That's fabulous. Now that's better, right? That's better. So the picture's a little more clearly defined then for your brain, but it's still not hitting the mark. It's still missing the mark. What you want to do, let me back up a second, guys. Our brains are engineered to be these goal-seeking mechanisms. It's like they're like a heat-seeking missile, right? Headed right for the goal. That's how our brains have been engineered by our creator. I mean, they're remarkable, all the things your brain does. There will never, ever in the history of humankind, ever, despite what you see on the movies, be a computer that can duplicate what the human brain does. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. The human brain today, despite all of our advances in medical science, remains largely a mystery. Largely a mystery. It's remarkable what it does. It's awesome. It's awesome. But here's the paradox. When we give instructions to our brains, we've got to give them in very simple, straightforward ways. Very simple, straightforward ways. In real estate, the best way to communicate with our brain is transaction sites. Boy, our brain can get a hold of that one. Listen, next year I want to do 50 transaction sites. I'd like 25 of them to be buyers, and I'd like 25 of them to be sellers. Man, your brain can run with that versus 16 million, right? Doesn't mean very much to your brain, 16 million. So I got a question here from Joanne. And her question is, would you recommend setting a goal to increase the average price point per transaction side rather than the number of transaction sides? Good question, Joanne. I would say that it depends. Maybe both, because I've got clients. I just was talking to one guy this morning. His average transaction commission per transaction went up $1,500 per transaction this year over last year. So last year, he set a goal to increase his average take per transaction, his average commission per transaction by $1,000. It actually was $1,500. You know, we did the math this morning. And so when you spread that over the number of transactions that he's done, which is 60 transactions, it's a heck of a lot of money. I'm punching it into my calculator there. It's almost $100,000. It's $90,000. That he made additionally this year just by bumping his price point a little bit. So yeah, absolutely. You know, increasing your average commission check per transaction, definitely. But it's not either or; it's and both. We want to increase that, and we also simultaneously want to increase the number of transaction sides we're doing. By what? Well, depending on who you are, maybe 20 to 25% the average number of transaction sides. And look, if we bump our average commission per transaction just by $1,000, it's not going to translate into that much more in sale price. You know, it's interesting, man. It's such a great question, Joanne. I love this question because I've had so many clients do this where they've said, you know, I want to bump up my average commission check per transaction. I want to collect more money each time that I do a real estate transaction. And the very act of stating that in simple terms, the very act of doing that and putting their attention and intention on doing that, it just seems to happen. They don't seem to go through any elaborate strategy to cause that to occur. You know, they don't say, well, I'm going to go farm. They just put their attention and intention on raising their sale price, and it just seems to happen. It's so interesting. I'm sitting here thinking, okay, the guy I just told you about and two other people that decided to do that last year with stellar results, remarkable. And the thing that blows my mind is that there wasn't really a strategy in place to cause that to happen. They just gave that instruction to their brain. Hey, you know, brain, I really want to increase my average commission check by $1,000 per check next year. And like the brain goes out there and just, you know, attracts that into their reality. So yes, you know, resounding yes. If we can handily increase our average commission check per transaction. I don't know if Greg Martyr is on the phone, but he's one of the people I'm thinking about. And he and I talked about this. You know, Greg's average commission check per transaction, by putting his attention and intention on this area, I'm not making this up, guys. In fact, I got to do the math on my calculator because I'm losing my math muscles because I'm so calculator dependent. But let me just do this real quickly. Yeah, five times. His average, I am not making this up. I promise you there's no hair on this. This guy went from an average commission check, believe it or not, of like $900 to $1,000 to $5,000. $5,000? I mean, that's unbelievable. by what? Telling his brain, look, I need to raise the bar here. You know, I need to stop groveling here in these lower price points. Now, guys, here's the other piece of this. Maybe not politically correct to say so, and I say this with the transparency of telling you all that I grew up, I always say we didn't grow up poor, just almost, right? And so I have a great affinity for people who grow up with meager means and who, you know, fight and claw their way up and who are quote-unquote self-made. There's no shame in that at all. And there's no shame when people, you know, if somebody's a janitor or a CEO or a brain surgeon or, you know, somebody who is on the trash detail. I mean, these are all honest labor. And, you know, I've done a lot of that stuff except brain surgery, right? I dug ditches one summer to come up with my room and board for college. You know, I get it. But here's the thing, you know, at the lower price points, there's definitely more problems. Sorry, just a fact. There's a heck of a lot more problems at a, you know, price point of 100,000, generally speaking, than there is at a price point of 500,000. It's just the way it rolls out. It is what it is. So when you raise your average commission check per transaction, you also are lowering the aggravation factor in the real estate business. It's remarkable. But Greg probably holds the record here. I mean, he told his brain, hey, man, I gotta get out of these lower price points. You know, he was, you know, wheelhouse maybe 50 to 70 grand, right? Changed his marketplace up. Holy smokes, you know, meaning the marketplace of price point. Just start putting his attention and intention on those higher price points. Didn't really implement any major strategy to do that. So yes, yes, yes. Okay. But again, here's the point. Simple, straightforward instructions to your brain. Stop talking to your brain in stupid emotional BS talk. Stop it. Your brain doesn't get it. It's not going to help you. Really, it's not going to help you. It's going to hurt you. All right. So just a quick review here on your production goals. Depending on your level of transaction size, you can double your production. You can do that. You know, when you're up there in the neighborhood of, you know, 12, 18 sides maybe, even, you know, you can double your production handily. When you get up to around 30 sides, going from 30 to 60, 60 to 120, 120 to 240, hey, not so much, man. Hold up. Those levels are 20 to 25% more. And you want to set your goals thoughtfully, in my opinion, prayerfully. You want to look at your past performance. You want to look at the infrastructure you have in play. You want to look at what this is going to mean in terms of time, energy, and resources devoted. You especially want to look at the time factor, as in my Dave Lineker story. And then you want to give your brain simple, straightforward instructions based in what? Transaction size. I want to do this many transaction sides on the seller side. I want to do this many on the buyer side for a total of this many, brain. And in deference to Joanne's point, right, if you feel you want to raise the bar in your average commission check, by all means, tell your brain that too, but keep it simple. One more, I can't help this, Joanne. You ruined my day, you know, because you put forth such a great point, and I didn't have it in my outline, and I'm jealous that you thought of it and I didn't. But here's the other piece of this, subtly different. But I had clients who, I say this with all due respect, right, who have had in the past head trash around what they're worth, their value in the marketplace. And I'm thinking of one person in particular, although I've had several, who would go into a listing appointment, and in this individual's marketplace, it was customary to charge 6%. Now, I don't want to get in trouble with the Federal Trade Commission. I know that commissions are negotiable in every marketplace, blah, 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 blah. But the bottom line is that in this particular marketplace, it was a 6% commission. And in this particular marketplace, believe it or not, it was customary for the listing agent to keep 3.5 and pay the selling agent 2.5, just the way that business is done in that marketplace. So my client was habitually going into these appointments, these listing appointments, and charging 5 and saying, I'll keep 2.5 and I'll pay 2.5 to the other guy. Everybody's happy. And when I asked, well, why are you doing that when it's customary to get 6? This individual felt that, well, you know, it's helping me to get the listing. Well, is it really? I don't think so. Right. And so I gave this person an assignment. I said, your next 3 listing appointments, I just want you to give me a commitment on the next 3 that you're going to ask for 6%. Just give me that commitment. If after 3, it's not working out for you and you get all kinds of pushback, I'll leave you alone. Just on the next 3, just ask for 6. Which this individual did and got 6% in all 3 and has never looked back. Well, what is that worth to this person? What was that worth to this person annually? You know, when we cut a commission, guys, it's not going to make much of a difference on any single transaction, is it? I mean, on any single transaction, cutting a commission isn't going to make much of a difference. But if we do it perennially, that means we do it all the time over a great number of transactions in a given year, it can have a devastating effect on us. And in this case, are you ready? $100,000, $100,000. This person was leaving on the table. Are you freaking kidding me? And it wasn't necessary all those years that this person was doing it. This person could have handily gotten 6. So what's the point here? Well, the point is that we want to increase our transaction size. We maybe want to increase our average price point or our average commission per transaction. And if we are undercutting our commissions, if we're undercutting what we charge, oh my gosh, you know, guys, by all means, we want to tell our brains that, hey, you know, I also next year want to earn blank percentage on each and every sale price, each and every house I sell, I want to earn X. You know, the other piece of this is that oftentimes in marketplaces, I come from a big marketplace up in the Philly area, right? So a lot of these agents will cut their commission and then, you know, advertise in the MLS that I'm getting less than X. And I would always call that agent and say, I'm bringing you a good offer on your listing, but here's the deal. I want a 3% commission. I put an addendum to the agreement of sale to that effect, and my buyer isn't going to pay it, right? So don't come back to me and say, well, we'll accept your offer, but you know, if you want your X percentage, then your buyer's going to have to pay it. I said, that's not going to happen. I've already prepped my buyer. If your seller wants to do that, that's fine, but we'll go find another house. And I got it most of the time, vast majority of the time. Now, look, when I paid out on my listings, when I paid the selling commission, the selling agent, they always got what was normal and customary in our marketplace. I didn't try to undercut them, but don't go cutting your commission and then expect me to eat it. It isn't going to happen on my watch ever. Now, see, Joanne just opened up Pandora's box, right? Because here's another deal. So I've got a client who the way that he increased his average, he didn't want to be bothered with changing his market, you know what I mean, raising his average sale price. And for very good reason, the price point that he's in is a very saleable price point. It's a bread and butter market. And so he did not want to up his his average sale price because he felt like, look, it's working for me. I mean, I'm taking these listings, they're all selling. So here's where everybody is going to like fall off their chair. So this guy decides that he wants to raise his average commission check per transaction. And he's not going to increase his sale price. And he's not going to cut the commission of the listing agent, he's not going to cut the commission of the selling agent in order that he might keep more. So you know what this dude decides to do? Raises his commission above what's normal and customary in his marketplace. He bumped it 0.5%, right? And he's getting it. Every time he lists a property, and he's a very heavy listing agent, so you know obviously can't do this on the buy side, but look, that's an option, isn't it? It takes a lot of gumption to execute. It takes a lot of faith in yourself and what you bring to the table. But the guy, I'm telling you, I'm not making this up. The guy did that, and he's successful most of the time. Most of the time, he's getting 0.5% more than what is customary in the marketplace. And he's worth it. Trust me, he's worth it. This guy's a great agent. But so here's the simple instruction to the brain. Next year, I'm charging 0.5% more than I have been charging when I'm the listing agent. Next year, if I'm getting less than X percent on the buyer, the buy side, when I have the buyer, I am going to submit my offer and ask for a commission that is normal and customary. I'm not taking a cut at Jump Street. Take some gumption. Look, guys, disclaimer, I don't know if that's quote-unquote permissible/legal in your marketplace. It was in mine. No problem with that stuff. I'm from Philly. You want to mess with our money? Look out. Okay, a final word about goals here, guys. We should be setting goals in seven areas, right? Seven areas in our lives. Spiritual goals, health and fitness goals, family goals, personal development goals, financial goals, career goals, and social goals. Some of these are personal goals. Some of these are business goals. Some of them are both. Some of them are both types of goals. But in your business plan, you know, it's a mistake to limit your goal setting to simply your production. I'll say that again. In our goal setting section, we spent the entire coaching session on goals, right? And I'm gonna finish up with goals. We'll work on this other stuff that comes after next coaching session. Why? It's the most important part of your business plan. That's why. No other reason. But your goals should not be limited solely to, under any and all circumstances, what you want to achieve production-wise. You need some other things in there. So, for example, I've got an old business plan here. It's my last business plan for my first full year in real estate business. And this is 2007, right? 2007. So, I'm looking here on this, and so I had my transaction size down, right? That year, 140 transactions. And I also had a net profit goal. Very important. Very important. So, it's, you know, if you do 140 transaction size or you do 14, right? It doesn't matter. But if you spend all or most of the commission money that you earn trying to do that business, what good is that, right? We want to have a healthy net profit. So I had a net profit goal there, which is a pretty nice net profit, I might add, which I did hit, right? I had 60 of those, 70 of those sides were going to be listing sides all by me, and 70 of those sides were going to be buyer agent sides, you know, buyer side transactions. That year, I can tell you that we were like 51-49, 51% seller sides, 49% buyer sides. I mean, we hit it on the head, man. And you typically, you know, want a pretty good balance between buyer sides and seller sides when you're a big team, or when you're even a moderate to to big team. You want to have an equal mix there. When you're a solo agent, it's just you. You're the only producer. You know, I think 60-40 is a good one. Maybe 65-35, meaning 60% sellers, 40% buyers. But that's in there. So I had my net profit in there. I had how many of those sides were going to be seller sides, how many were going to be buyer sides. And let me just look here. And the ratio, yeah. So that was in there with my production goals. I also had lead generation goals. So for those 140 transactions, what I did is I broke out where they were going to come from based on what? I guess no, based on history. Based on history, and also based on areas where we could raise the bar. And I can tell you right now, where a lot of people can raise the bar is with their ProQuest calls. You know, getting to a place where we're converting more and more of those calls to commission dollars. Guys, I've got to tell you, you know, if we're not converting over time at least half or more of the inbound ProQuest calls, notice I said over time because a lot of the calls maybe are later on business, but man, you should be converting half or more. Don't be content with converting 10 or 20%, saying, oh, well, gee whiz, I mean, I'm converting this many and I'm happy with that. You know, don't be happy with that. So I had lead generation goals. So I said, okay, this team wants to do 140 transactions. Look, guys, the number doesn't matter. The transaction side doesn't matter. What matters is the principle. If you're doing 40, if you want to do 40 sides next year, answer the question, where is this business going to come from, and set goals around that. Okay, we're going to do 40 transactions. Okay, 20 are going to come from referrals and repeats. You know, 10 of them will come from inbound ProQuest calls. That's 30. Another 10 will come from expireds. You get the idea. Okay, so what else do I have here? I have a provision in here in this business plan that we were going to improve in certain skill set areas, mostly around the lead conversion side of the equation. And so you've got to get real specific with your goals. Again, you've got to give your brain simple instructions. So you've heard me talk about defaults on the lead conversion calls. I wanted myself and my agents to have all of the defaults dialed in. Somebody says, well, what do you think my house is worth? Well, sir, I really couldn't ever answer that on the phone. I need to see it first so I can give you a real good evaluation. When can we get together? See, that's a default. That's the default. Why should we use your company? I'm not sure that you should, sir. I need to know a lot more about your situation. When can we get together? Right? Default. Always a default. So when we were getting better at the lead generation game, we wanted to have those defaults dialed in. Whenever a prospect said something, we fed it back in a manner that was consistent across the board. So there was goals in there. Looking here, I had some budget goals, right? You know, that had to do with the net income goals, right? So, you know, we wanted a business budget that we stuck to. Very little flexibility in there. Organizational goals. Do you want to hire an assistant? Do you want to bring on your first buyer agent? Right? Do you, you know, I have a goal in here that we wanted to upgrade our computer equipment. We wanted to upgrade software. We wanted to make improvements to our website. I'm just looking here. Okay, we wanted to ensure that we had solid relationships in play, strategic alliances, I call them, with mortgage and title company. So there's a lot more than production goals that go into this goal setting area. Are there any designations that you want to earn, right? Do you want to consider a coaching program next year? And that's not a commercial. I'm just putting it out there, right? That might be a goal for some of you. I think I said this already, but, you know, guys, I had this conversation with somebody yesterday. Next year, unless your production, your personal production is at a max, and what's the max? Look, I think most people max out about 60 sides, you know, or so, with an assistant, with a full-time assistant. If you're not at 60 sides and you don't have an assistant, I'm going to be blunt. You have no business hiring a buyer agent. You're not ready for a buyer agent. Your own personal production isn't maxed out. Why in the hay would you ever hire a team agent if your own personal production isn't at its max? That's nuts. If you're a team leader next year, are there some people that we need to weed out, right? Every once in a while, you got to thin out the herd. People just aren't working out for one reason or another. Sometimes it's admin. More often than not, it's a team agent. Now, I often think of my wife. My wife is the captain of her women's tennis team down here in South Carolina. And, she's a tennis nut. And, being the captain of the team is, a thankless job, to be honest with you. I would never want that job. And so there's a woman that had come out to the team, and joined the team. There's no tryouts, you just get to be on the team. And long story short, this woman came out 3 years ago and not only hasn't gotten better, right? Hasn't gotten better. She's actually gotten worse each year. Her game has gotten, poorer and poorer. And my wife said to me, well, I don't know what to say to her. I really don't, because I can't play her in a league match. She's just terrible. If I play her in a league match, we're going to lose. And I said, well, what would you like to say to her? And my wife said, I'd like to sit down with her and say, Sally, maybe this just isn't your game, right? Maybe this just isn't your game. Well, look, for you team leaders out there, maybe somebody's on the team and they're in they're a team agent. Maybe it isn't their game. This game is not for everybody, right? So let's be thorough with our goals. It's not just our production. There's career things in there. There's net profit here. How many buyer and seller sides? But God forbid we make it too complicated, because our brains aren't going to get it, and then we're gonna underperform. Simple instructions to your brain. Clear, concise, simple instructions to your brain, and your brain will execute. I promise. So we're going to pick up next time with your operating budget. This is where it gets a little gnarly. I think today's call, for me anyway, very compelling material. It's stuff that I get really excited about. But when we start getting into budgets and so forth, I mean, that's where we lose a lot of salespeople. But hang with me, guys. I promise you that I'll do my very best to keep that material moving. Right, and you'll get something from it. And I want to thank Joanne for her question today, because it really, I think, helped a lot of people. So we'll see you 1 week from today. We'll continue with our business plan. Get out there and buy your 1.5-inch binder. Buy your Avery tabs. Let's get our business plans done by Thanksgiving. So we'll see you next week. In the meantime, get out there, chop wood, carry water, and do it like you mean it. God bless you.